Well, good evening and welcome to the Croydon Buddhist Centre and to tonight's poetry reading, which is quite a special event to have here. Sangharakshita, or Banti, as most of us know him, doesn't appear that often in public. As you know, the subject of the poetry reading tonight is friendship. As you can see from the programme, we'll be starting with some poetry readings. Then there'll be a musical interval in which we'll hear the friendship duet from the Pearlfishers, and then we'll conclude the main part of the evening with further poetry readings. After that, there'll be a book launch from Naga Bodhi, who runs Windhorse Publication, which is the publishing arm of the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, of which the Croydon Buddhist Centre is a part. And then after that, there'll be tea served in the bookshop and a book signing session. Banti will be happy to sign any of his books that you might wish to buy. Before we go on to the poetry readings, I'd just like to say a few more words by way of introducing Banti. The way most of us who know Banti know him is through his prose writings, The Survey of Buddhism, The Three Jewels, and so on, as well as through the large number of taped lectures that he's delivered over the years. And some of us also know him personally. But Banti also has a strong interest in poetry. And over the years, beginning at an early age, he's written quite a lot of poetry. And we have two volumes of his poetry on sale in the bookshop, Conquering New Worlds and The Enchanted Heart. Enchanted Heart, there's only about a dozen copies left on sale in the world, so if you want one of them, you have to... We've only got three of them, so could be your last chance for a while. But poetry is a medium through which Buddhism, or the Dharma, can be very effectively communicated, and through which Banti himself does very effectively communicate the Dharma, often in quite a personal sort of way. We could say that Banti's poetry is perhaps merits more attention within the Buddhist world and the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order than it gets at the moment. Tonight, Banti isn't going to be reading from his own poetry, but from a selection of poets, both ancient and modern, around the theme of friendship, a theme which is central to Buddhism and something we place very high value on in the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. So I'll now hand you over to Banti to read the poems he's selected for tonight.
As we've just heard from Dharmaguchi, friendship is a theme of central importance in Buddhism, especially in the form of spiritual friendship, and a theme which therefore is of central importance and interest in the life and work of the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. I think you probably will not come along to an FWBO centre more than two or three times at the most before hearing the magic words spiritual friendship. And if you go along to a retreat, then you very likely will find, it will be very surprising if you don't find, that spiritual friendship is very much in the air. Now this evening I'm not going to give a talk on spiritual friendship or on friendship even. I'm just going to read some poems. For reasons which I don't altogether understand myself, I've rather gone off giving lectures. I must have given several tens of thousands of lectures already in the course of my life. But I haven't really quite gone off reading poetry. So I have been thinking over the last few months, well, friendship is a theme that does need to be emphasised, perhaps even more than we actually do emphasise it. But I won't give a lecture on it, as I might have done 10 or 15 years ago. I'll read some poems on the subject, on the theme of friendship. And I started browsing through English poetry, translations from other languages also, and I gradually assembled a little collection of poems on the subject of friendship. And it's that little collection that I'm going to read you this evening. And it will be punctuated halfway through, as you've already heard, by a little music. Not so much by an interval, if I may say so, because I don't want you to always go streaming out of the door as soon as you hear the music, but an interlude, rather, shall we say. Just one little item on a cassette. I mentioned that I've made this little collection of poems, and I thought it would be a good idea to arrange them in sections so that the reading wasn't too miscellaneous. So after quite a bit of thought, I arrived at five sections, so that the poems are grouped under these five headings. We have, first of all, Friendship in the Heroic Age. We then have Rejoicing in Friends and Friendship. And then Remembering Friends. Then comes the musical interlude, after which we have Friendship in War. And finally, Higher Dimensions. Now, there were other aspects of friendship which I would have liked to have more poems on, but unfortunately I couldn't find them. I would have liked to have had a few more poems on the subject of friendship and death. Death, you may remember, was the theme of the last poetry reading I gave here, or at least one of the themes. I also would have liked to have had more poems on the subject of friendship between women. But I'm afraid I could find very, very few poems on that particular topic. So in this connection, I'd like to say that if you personally know of any poems on friendship, which are good poems and which I haven't included in my reading this evening, please send them to me, and I'll be happy to incorporate them in future readings, which I may well be giving. So let's start. Before the first section, we have just a sort of prelude or prologue. And it comes from a very well-known work called The Prophet by Khalil Gibran. And Khalil Gibran was a Lebanese. He was a poet and a mystic, and he lived in this century. And The Prophet is his most famous work. And in this work, there's an sort of imaginary prophet figure to whom all sorts of people put all sorts of questions. A very familiar sort of setup. They say, speak to us about this and speak to us about that. And eventually someone asks him to speak about friendship, which he does. So it's that particular chapter of the prophet, which I'm going to start off with this evening. I think it strikes the sort of note that we will be sounding throughout the reading. And the youth said, speak to us of friendship. And he answered, saying, your friend is your needs answered. He is your field which you sow with love and reap with thanksgiving. And he is your board and your fireside. For you come to him with your hunger, and you seek him for peace. When your friend speaks his mind, you fear not the nay in your own mind, nor do you withhold the eye. And when he is silent, your heart ceases not to listen to his heart. For without words, in friendship, all thoughts, all desires, all expectations are born and shared with joy that is unacclaimed. When you part from your friend, you grieve not, for that which you love most in him may be clearer in his absence, as the mountain to the climber is clearer from the plain. Let there be no purpose in friendship, save the deepening of the spirit. For love that seeks aught but the disclosure of its own mystery is not love, but a net cast forth, and only the unprofitable is caught. And let your best be for your friend. If he must know the ebb of your tide, let him know its flood also. For what is your friend that you should seek him with hours to kill? Seek him always with hours to live. For it is his to fill your need, but not your emptiness. And in the sweetness of friendship, let there be laughter and sharing of pleasures. For in the dew of little things, the heart finds its morning and is refreshed. Section 1, Friendship in the Heroic Age. And we go back to a very heroic age indeed. We go back to the Epic of Gilgamesh. And the Epic of Gilgamesh goes back some 4,500 years. Gilgamesh was king of Uruk in Mesopotamia, which is now part of Iraq. And Gilgamesh had a very great friend called Enkidu. And before they actually met, both Gilgamesh and Enkidu had a sort of intuition about this coming great friendship. And the text says, Enkidu longed for a comrade, one who would understand his heart. Because that's just what a friend is. A friend is one who understands your heart. And likewise, Gilgamesh himself had a dream. In fact, he has several dreams about this friend he was about to meet. The actual meeting was rather dramatic. In fact, the text tells us that Enkidu, when he heard about Gilgamesh, wanted to challenge him. And this is what we see in the first extract, which I'm now going to read, from the Epic of Gilgamesh. Then Enkidu stepped out. He stood in the street and blocked the way. Mighty Gilgamesh came on, and Enkidu met him at the gate. He put out his foot and prevented Gilgamesh from entering the house. So they grappled, holding each other like bulls. They broke the doorposts and the walls shook. They snorted like bulls locked together. They shattered the doorposts and the walls shook. Gilgamesh bent his knee with his foot planted on the ground, and with a turn Enkidu was thrown. Then immediately his fury died. When Enkidu was thrown, he says to Gilgamesh, there is not another like you in the world. Nimsun, who is as strong as the wild ox in the byre, she was the mother who bore you, and now you are raised above all men, and Enlil has given you the kingship, for your strength surpasses the strength of men. So Enkidu and Gilgamesh embraced, and their friendship was sealed. That's what we nowadays call fierce friendship. So Gilgamesh and Enkidu have all sorts of adventures together, as recounted in the epic, but unfortunately one day Gilgamesh loses Enkidu. Enkidu dies. And after his death, Gilgamesh goes in quest of everlasting life. You might say a rather Buddhistic idea. We're rather reminded of the Buddha seeing those four sights. The old man, the sick man, the dead man, and then the sadhu, the monk, and then going in quest of Nibbana. But before Gilgamesh goes in quest of everlasting life, he laments the loss of Enkidu, and he laments the loss in this elegy 4,500 years ago. Hear me, great ones of Uruk. I weep for Enkidu, my friend, bitterly moaning like a woman mourning. I weep for my brother. O Enkidu, my brother, you were the axe at my side, my hands of strength, the sword in my belt, the shield before me, a glorious robe, my fairest ornament. An evil fate has robbed me. The wild ass and the gazelle that were father and mother, all long-tailed creatures that nourished you, weep for you. All the wild things of the plain and pastures, the paths that you loved in the forest of cedars, night and day murmur. Let the great ones of strong-walled Uruk weep for you. Let the finger of blessing be stretched out in mourning. Enkidu, young brother, hark, there is an echo through all the country, like a mother mourning. Weep, all the paths where we walked together, and the beasts we hunted, the bear and hyena, tiger and panther, leopard and lion, the stag and the ibex, the bull and the doe. The river along whose banks we used to walk weeps for you, Ulla of Elam and dear Euphrates, where once we drew water for the water skins. The mountain we climbed where we slew the watchman weeps for you, the warriors of strong-walled Uruk, where the bull of heaven was killed, weep for you. All the people of Eridu weep for you, Enkidu. Those who brought grain for your eating mourn for you now, who rubbed oil on your back mourn for you now, who poured beer for your drinking mourn for you now. The harlot who anointed you with fragrant ointment laments for you now. The women of the palace who brought you a wife, a chosen ring of good advice, lament for you now. And the young men, your brothers, as though they were women, go long-haired in mourning. What is this sleep which holds you now? You are lost in the dark and cannot hear me. So, remaining in the heroic age, going forward quite a few thousand years, we come to China. We come to the Shi King, or Classic of Poetry. This is one of the five Confucian classics. Originally, we're told there were some 3,000 and more ancient poems, and the great Confucius made a selection from these poems. He selected just over 300, and these 300 poems, selected by Confucius in the 6th century BC, have come down to us as the Shi King, or Classic of Poetry. The poems go back, it seems, to the period roughly 1000 to 750 BC. So even though they're not as ancient as the Epic of Gilgamesh, they're still very ancient indeed. I'm going to read you just two of these songs. The first is entitled by the translator Brotherly Affection, and there's a footnote which says, sung at feasts given by the king to those of his own clan or surname. Clansmen might perhaps be substituted for brothers throughout. I should also mention that brother, the word brother as used in the song, seems to mean something rather more like what we would call friendship, and the word friend seems to correspond more to what we would call acquaintance. So, brotherly affection. Is not the cherry tree all round, with opening blossoms grandly crowned? So, nowhere in the world of men is A, the like of brothers found, bereaved by death in ways we dread? How is the brother's heart oppressed? Or hill and dale, mid heaps of dead, brother for brother makes his quest. Quick, like the wagtails on the moor, are brothers when sore needs arise? Though each may have good friends and sure, their help is in continual size. Though brothers may have private feud, they fight as one the alien foe, and each has friends both sure and good. But friends to help? Ah, surely no. When woes and strife are at an end, and peace and quietness prevail, though some have brothers, now the friend, the incomparable friend, they hail. Make thee a feast, make all complete, and drink thy heart's content of wine. 'Tis when the band of brothers meet that mirth and childlike joy combine. Union with wife and child is sweet, sweet as when lutes in concert blend. 'Tis when united brothers meet that mirth and concord know no end. Ye then who rule your households well, ye who in wife or child's delight, study these words and let them tell if I have spoken truth and right. That's, as it were, a slightly collective poem, but this one is more, as it were, individual. It's entitled Comrades in Wartime. It deals with the friendship between just two people. And it goes like this. How say we have no clothes? One plaid for both will do. Let but the king, in raising men, our spears and pikes renew. We'll fight as one, we two. How say we have no clothes? One skirt our limbs shall hide. Let but the king, in raising men, halberd and lance provide. We'll do it, side by side. How say we have no clothes? My kirtle thou shalt wear. Let but the king, in raising men, armour and arms prepare. The toils of war we'll share. Well, you can take that literally or metaphorically. Now to the heroic age in Greece, Homer's Iliad. An extract. I'd better just place the story for you. The great hero of the Iliad is, of course, Achilles. And Achilles has a great friend, Patroclus. And when this episode begins, Patroclus, Achilles' great friend, has just been killed by Hector, the Trojan chief. And in revenge, Achilles has just killed Hector after chasing him round the walls of Troy. And Achilles has dragged the corpse of Hector to his camp, and there he gives instructions to his men, the Myrmidons, to prepare a pyre for Patroclus so that he can be cremated with full honours. I should also mention that in this extract, Achilles is referred to as Pelides. Pelides means son of Peleus, Peleus being his father. So remember, Pelides means Achilles. So Achilles has just given his orders to his men about the construction of this magnificent funeral pyre. He spoke. They hear him, and the word obey. The rage of hunger and of thirst allay. Then ease in sleep the labours of the day. But great Pelides, stretched along the shore, where, dashed on rocks, the broken billows roar, lies inly groaning, while on either hand the martial Myrmidons confusedly stand. Along the grass his languid members fall, tired with his chase around the Trojan wall. Hushed by the murmurs of the roaring deep. At length he sinks in the soft arms of sleep. When lo, the shade before his closing eyes of sad Patroclus rose, or seemed to rise. In the same robe he living wore, he came, in stature, voice, and pleasing look, the same. The form familiar hovered o'er his head. And sleeps Achilles? Thus the phantom said. Sleeps my Achilles? Is Patroclus dead? Living, I seemed his dearest, tenderest care, but now forgot, I wander in the air. Let my pale corse the rites of burial know, and give me entrance in the realms below. Till then, the spirit finds no resting place, but here and there the unbodied spectres chase the vagrant dead around the dark abode, forbid to cross the irremeable flood. Now give thy hand, for to the farther shore, when once we pass, the soul returns no more. When once the last funereal flames ascend, no more shall meet Achilles and his friend. No more our thoughts to those we love to make known, or quit the dearest to converse alone. Me fate has severed from the sons of earth, the fate foredoomed that waited from my birth. Thee too it waits, before the Trojan war, even great and godlike thou art doomed to fall. Hear then, and as in fate and love we join, ah, suffer that my bones may rest with thine. Together have we lived, together bred, one house received us, and one table fed. That golden urn thy goddess mother gave may mix our ashes in one common grave. And is it thou, he answers, to my sight, once more returned thou from the realms of night? O more than brother, think each office paid, whate'er can rest a discontented shade. But grant one last embrace, unhappy boy, afford at least that melancholy joy. He said, and with his longing arms essayed, in vain to grasp the visionary shade. Like a thin smoke he sees the spirit fly, and hears a feeble, lamentable cry. Confused he wakes, amazement breaks the bands of golden sleep, and starting from the sands, pensive he muses with uplifted hands. 'Tis true, 'tis certain, man, though dead, retains part of himself. The immortal mind remains. The form subsists without the body's aid, an aerial semblance and an empty shade. This knight, my friend, so late in battle lost, stood at my side, a pensive, plaintive ghost. Even now familiar, as in life he came. Alas, how different, yet how like the same. Thus, while he spoke, each eye grew big with tears, and now the rosy-fingered morn appears, shows every mournful face with tears o'erspread, and glares on the pale visage of the dead. Now to section 2, rejoicing in friends and friendship. And we're going to start off with a great favourite, at least a great favourite of mine. Some of you must have heard it or read it before. The author, also I must say, is a great favourite of mine, none other than Dr. Samuel Johnson. And it's An Ode on Friendship. And this poem was written, it seems, when Johnson was a very young man. It would seem that it was written in his teens. He may have been only 17 or 18 when he wrote it, in a very enthusiastic mood. So, An Ode on Friendship. Friendship, peculiar boon of heaven, the noble mind's delight and pride, to men and angels only given, to all the lower world denied. While love, a stranger to the blessed, parent of thousand wild desires, the human and the savage breast, inflames alike with raging fires, with bright but oft destructive gleam, alike o'er all his lightnings fly. Thy lambent glory's only beam around the favourites of the sky. Directress of the brave and just, O guide me through life's darksome way, and let the tortures of mistrust on selfish bosoms only prey. Thy gentle flows of guiltless joys on fools and villains ne'er descend. In vain for thee the monarch sighs and hugs a flatterer for a friend. When virtues, kindred virtues meet, and sister souls together join, thy pleasures, permanent as great, are all transporting, all divine. Oh, must their ardours cease to glow when souls to blissful climes removed? What raised our virtues here below shall aid our happiness above. So from the 18th century and Samuel Johnson to the 19th century and Walt Whitman. I saw in Louisiana a live oak growing. I saw in Louisiana a live oak growing. All alone stood it, and the moss hung down from the branches. Without any companion it grew there, uttering joyous leaves of dark green. And its look, rude, unbending, lusty, made me think of myself. But I wondered how it could utter joyous leaves, standing alone there, without its friend near. For I knew I could not. And I broke off a twig with a certain number of leaves upon it, and twined around it a little moss, and brought it away. I have placed it in sight in my room. It is not needed to remind me as of my own dear friends, for I believe lately I think of little else than of them. Yet it remains to me a curious token. It makes me think of manly love. For all that, and though the live oak glistens there in Louisiana, solitary in a wide flat space, uttering joyous leaves all its life, without a friend, a lover near, I know very well I could not. Now to the end of the last century. A poet of the 90s, the 1890s, Lionel Johnson. And this poem is called simply, A Friend. It's a tribute to someone who must have been a very close, a very dear friend of Lionel Johnson. A friend. All that he came to give, he gave and went again. I have seen one man live. I have seen one man reign with all the graces in his train. As one of us he wrought things of the common hour. Whence was the charmed soul brought that gave each act such power? The natural beauty of a flower, magnificence and grace, excellent courtesy, a brightness on the face, airs of high memory. Whence came all of these to such as he? Like young Shakespearean kings, he won the adoring throng, And as Apollo sings, he triumphed with a song, triumphed and sang and passed along. With a light word he took the hearts of men in thrall, and with a golden look welcomed them, at his call giving their love, their strength, their all. No man less proud than he, nor cared for homage less, only he could not be far off from happiness. Nature was bound to his success. Weary, the cares, the jars, the lets of every day, but the heavens filled with stars. Now back in time a little, back to the 16th century, back to Shakespeare and his sonnet number 30. When to the sessions of sweet silent thought I summon up remembrance of things past, I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought, and with old woes new wail my dear time's waste. Then can I drown an eye unused to flow for precious friends hid in death's dateless night, and weep afresh love's long since cancelled woe, and moan the expense of many a vanished sight. Then can I grieve at grievances foregone, and heavily from woe to woe tell o'er the sad account of four bemoaned moan, which I knew pay, as if not paid before. But if the while I think on thee, dear friend, all losses are restored, and sorrows end. Now comes a more modern poem, a poem from the 20th century by Edward Thomas, and being a modern poem, of course, is going to be a little difficult. But anyway, we'll do our best. It's called The Sun That Used to Shine. The sun used to shine while we two walked slowly together, paused and started again, and sometimes mused, sometimes talked, as either pleased, and cheerfully parted each night. We never disagreed which gate to rest on, the to be, and the late past we gave small heed. Returned from men or poetry to rumours of the war remote, only till both stood disinclined for odd, but the yellow, flavorous coat of an apple wasps had undermined. Sorry, seem to have lost a page. For a century of dark betonies, the stateliest of small flowers on earth at the forest verge, or crocuses, pale purple as if they had their birth in sunless Hades fields. The war came back to mind with the moon rise, which soldiers in the east afar beheld then. Nevertheless, our eyes could as well imagine the Crusades or Caesar's battles. Everything to faintness like those rumours fades, like the brook's water glittering under the moonlight, like those walks now, like us two that took them, and the fallen apples, all the talks and silences, like memory's sand when the tide covers it late or soon, and other men through other flowers in those fields under the same moon go talking and have easy hours. Now we go all the way to China, and a poem by Wang Wei, who was one of the great poets of the Tang Dynasty, roughly 8th century AD. So it's entitled, A Farewell to Qi Wu Qiu, who has failed in his examinations and is returning home to the country. Don't forget, in ancient China, examinations were the key, the passport to official life. In this golden age, there are none that flee official life. Talent and intelligence show themselves at court. And so it came about that you, a stranger from the eastern hills, left your herb gathering and came to court. On your arrival at the distant gold doors of the capital, who could say that your principles would not find employment? You came from the country of the Yangtze and the Huai, at the time of the feast of the spring equinox. And in the capital, you had to mend your spring clothes. We pledge you with wine on the road from Chang'an. A friend dear to my heart goes on his way. You must now float away on your cinnamon boat. Soon you will arrive at your country retreat. The distant forests will lead you on your way. From afar, you will see this lonely city gleaming in the rays of the setting sun. Although I schemed, unhappily they failed to employ you. Think not that your good qualities are entirely unappreciated. Then, to close this section, Rejoicing in Friends and Friendship, another poem by Samuel Johnson, this time on the death of Dr. Robert Levitt. It's a poem occasioned by the death of a great friend of Johnson's, but it is a poem that rejoices in his merits, which doesn't lament his death. Robert Levitt had been an inmate of Johnson's house for about 20 years. Outwardly, he was a quite unprepossessing, a quite unattractive sort of person. He was a sort of doctor, we'd probably call him a quack, huh? And he worked among the poorest of the poor, and they were so poor that they usually couldn't pay him. The most common form of payment seems to have been a glass of gin, which he readily accepted. Although he was not at all an attractive character, it seems Johnson really appreciated him and missed him when he died. So this, here's this very moving poem which Johnson wrote on that occasion, when he himself was quite an old man. On the death of Dr. Robert Levitt. Condemned to hope's delusive mine, as on we toil from day to day, by sudden blasts or slow decline, as social comforts drop away. Well tried through many a varying year, see Levitt to the grave descend, officious, innocent, sincere, of every friendless name the friend. Yet still he fills affection's eye, obscurely wise and coarsely kind. Nor lettered arrogance deny thy praise to merit unrefined. When fainting nature called for aid, and hovering death prepared the blow, his vigorous remedy displayed the power of art without the show. In misery's darkest caverns known, his useful care was ever nigh, where hopeless anguish poured his groan, and lonely want retired to die. No summons mocked by chill delay, no petty gain disdained by pride. The modest wants of every day, the toil of every day supplied. His virtues walked their narrow round, nor made a pause, nor left a void. And sure the eternal master found the single talent well employed. The busy day, the peaceful night, unfelt, uncounted, glided by. His frame was firm, his powers were bright, though now his 80th year was nigh. Then with no throbbing fiery pain, no cold gradations of decay, death broke at once the vital chain and freed his soul the nearest way. Now to our third section, a rather short one, Remembering Friends. And again a poem from China by one great poet about another great poet, Tu Fu, also of the Tang Dynasty, writing about Li Po, again of the Tang Dynasty. The poem is called Dreaming of Li Po. The partings caused by death are swallowed in silence, but those among the living are a source of never-ending grief. Alas, from the malarial swamps south of Chang'an, the exile sends no news. Ah, my old friend, how I dream of you. Clearly our long friendship is reflected in my mind, yet I fear lest your spirit should be among the ghosts. Immeasurable is the distance that divides us, yet as your shade comes to me, the maples turn green, and as it goes, the mountain pass turns black. But today you are caught in the political net, and the spirit is not your earthly shape, for are you not incalculably far away? The setting moon strikes the rafters of my home, and it still seems to light up your face. The water is deep, and the waves are wide. Do not allow the scaly dragon to get you. The drifting clouds float by all day. The traveling friend goes far away and does not return. For 3 nights running I dreamed of you, and in my love for you I knew your thoughts. When you said farewell you had a hurried air, the road was hard, and your coming had not been easy. Much wind ruffles the surfaces of the Yangtze River and the Tungting Lake. I fear the paddles of your boat may be lost. In my dreams, I saw you come out of a doorway scratching your white head as if you were betraying your life's purpose. Here in the capital we are resplendent with official umbrellas and the regalia of office. You alone are sad and distracted. Truly, alas, the net has closed over you, and this old body of yours must bear with the meshes. A fame that will last thousands of years is but a lonely mockery when life is past. Now back to England, back to the Romantic period, and to a poem by Wordsworth. It's a poem written by Wordsworth in his old age, remembering dead poets who'd been his friends. He mentions the poem is called Extempore Effusion Upon the Death of James Hogg. James Hogg was a Scottish poet, well known in his day, often called the Ettrick Shepherd, and it's because he came from Ettrick, and it's as the Ettrick Shepherd that Wordsworth refers to him in the poem itself. He also refers to the Border Minstrel, or simply the Minstrel. That is, of course, Sir Walter Scott, who had also died recently. Then he speaks of Coleridge, again, who had died recently, and of Lamb, who was not a poet but an essayist, and then Crabbe, the author of Peter Grimes, also recently dead, and last of all, a woman poet, Felicia Hemans, who had died young, just very shortly before. So, Extempore Effusion Upon the Death of James Hogg. When first descending from the moorlands, I saw the stream of Yarrow glide along a bare and open valley. The Ettrick shepherd was my guide. When last along its banks I wandered, through groves that had begun to shed their golden leaves upon the pathways, my steps the border minstrel led. The mighty minstrel breathes no longer, mid mouldering ruins low he lies, and death upon the braes of Yarrow has closed the shepherd poet's eyes. Nor has the rolling year twice measured from sign to sign its steadfast course, since every mortal power of Coleridge was frozen at its marvellous source. The rapt one of the godlike forehead, the heaven-eyed creature sleeps in earth, and the lamb, the frolic and the gentle, has vanished from his lonely hearth. Like clouds that rake the mountain summits, or waves that own no curbing hand, how fast has brother followed brother from sunshine to the sunless land? Yet I, whose lids from infant slumber were earlier raised, remain to hear a timid voice that asks in whispers, who next will drop and disappear? Our haughty life is crowned with darkness, like London with its own black wreath, on which with thee, O crab, forth-looking, I gazed from Hampstead's breezy heath. As if but yesterday departed, thou too art gone before. But why, or ripe fruit seasonably gathered, should frail survivors heave a sigh? Mourn rather for that holy spirit, sweet as the spring, as ocean deep, for her who, ere her summer faded, has sunk into a breathless sleep. No more of old romantic sorrows, for slaughtered youth or lovelorn maid. With sharper grief is Yarrow smitten, and Ettrick mourns with her their poet dead. An extract now from a poetic drama. It's the Two Noble Kinsmen, which is usually attributed to Shakespeare and Fletcher. Fletcher, of course, of Beaumont and Fletcher. And it could be that this very extract is from Shakespeare's pen. Scholars discuss this quite extensively. It's not certain, but very likely it's by Shakespeare. I must again give a little of the setting and the story. There are two characters in this little dialogue, as it were. One is Hippolyta and the other is Emilia. Hippolyta was formerly the queen of the Amazons. She was a warrior, and she was defeated by the hero Theseus, who thereupon married her. And Emilia is her sister. And just a little while earlier on in the play, Theseus and his great friend Pirithous have gone away to fight. And after Pirithous' departure, the two women, Hippolyta and her sister Emilia, talk between themselves about the great friendship that exists between Theseus and Pirithous. But then, following upon that discussion, Emilia starts recounting a friendship that she herself enjoyed in her own earlier days, when she was very young. So Emilia says, I was acquainted once with a time when I enjoyed a playfellow. You were at wars when she, the grave enriched, who made too proud the bed, took leave of the moon, which then looked pale at parting, when our count was each 11. Hippolyta. 'Twas Flavina. Emilia. Yes. You talk of Pirithous and Theseus, love. Theirs has more ground, is more maturely seasoned, more buckled with strong judgment. And their needs, the one of the other, may be said to water their intertangled roots of love. But I, and she I sigh and spoke of, were things innocent, loved for we did, and like the elements that know not what nor why, yet do effect rare issues by their operance, our souls did so to one another. What she liked was then of me approved, what not condemned, no more arraignment. The flower that I would pluck and put between my breasts, oh then but beginning to swell about the blossom, she would long till she had such another, and commit it to the like innocent cradle, where phoenix-like they died in perfume. On my head no toy, but was her pattern, her affections, pretty, though happily her careless wear, I followed for my most serious decking. Had mine ear stolen some new air, or at adventure hummed one from musical coinage, why, it was a note whereon her spirits would sojourn, rather dwell on, and sing it in her slumbers. This rehearsal, which every innocent what's well comes in, like all importments bastard, is this end, that the true love tween maid and maid may be more than in sex dividual. Hippolyta, you're out of breath, and this high-speeded pace is but to say that you shall never, like the maid Flavina, love any that's called man. Emilia, I'm sure I shall not. Then to conclude this section, the first part of our reading, an extract from Coleridge, whom we've just heard Wordsworth lamenting. From Coleridge's Christabel. Again, let me give a little introduction, introducing the story, so to speak. A strange lady called Geraldine has arrived at the Baron's castle late one night, and she spends the night with the Baron's daughter, Christabel, and in the morning, Christabel takes her new friend, takes Geraldine, to meet her father, the Baron. The lovely maid and the lady tall are pacing both into the hall, and pacing on through page and groom, enter the Baron's presence room. The Baron rose, and while he pressed his gentle daughter to his breast, with cheerful wonder in his eyes, the Lady Geraldine espies, and gave such welcome to the same as might beseem so bright a dame. But when he heard the lady's tale, and when she told her father's name, why waxed Sir Leoline so pale, murmuring all the name again? Lord Roland de Vaux of Triermain. Alas, they had been friends in youth, but whispering tongues can poison the truth, and constancy lives in realms above. When life is thorny and youth is vain, and to be wroth with one we love doth work like madness in the brain. And thus it chanced, as I divine, with Roland and Sir Leoline. Each spake words of high disdain and insults to his heart's best brother. They parted, ne'er to meet again, but never either found another to free the hollow heart from paining. They stood aloof, the scars remaining, like cliffs which had been rent asunder. A dreary sea now flows between, but neither heat, nor frost, nor thunder shall wholly do away, I ween, the marks of that which once hath been. Sir Leoline, a moment's space, stood gazing on the damsel's face, and the youthful Lord of Triermain came back upon his heart again. Now then, for the musical interlude, and it's the very well-known friendship duet, as it's often called, from the Pearl Fishers, and the duet is sung by a very famous Swedish tenor who died some years ago, Jussi Jörling. I'm not quite sure if I pronounced his name correctly. Perhaps someone may correct me. Jussi Jörling? Björling, sorry. And Robert Merrill. I think I've got Robert Merrill right, anyway. And there's a little sort of program note here which I'll read. It says, Zerga, leader of the Ceylonese pearl fishers, and his friend Nader, were reunited after a long separation caused by their love for the priestess Leela. They recall her beauty and charm, but realize she threatens their friendship, which they vowed to uphold. So the friendship duet from Bizet's The Pearl of Fishers.
Thank you.
assured me it was the very best that could be found. So, on to our fourth section, friendship in war. The first poem in this section is by F.S. Flint, and incidentally, with one exception, all the poems in this section are associated with or connected with the First World War, which does seem to have thrown up quite a number of good poets. And quite a few of them wrote on this theme of friendship. So the poem is called Soldiers to R.A. Brother, I saw you on a muddy road in France, pass by with your battalion, rifle at the slope, full marching order, arms swinging, and I stood at ease, folding my hands over my rifle with my battalion. You passed me by, and our eyes met. We had not seen each other since the days we climbed the Devon Hills together. Our eyes met, startled. And, because the order was silence, we dared not speak. O face of my friend, alone distinct of all that company, you went on into the darkness. And I sit here at my table, holding back my tears, with my jaw set and my teeth clenched, knowing I shall not be even so near you as I saw you in my dream. Then a poem by Wilfred Gibson, Sentry Go. True lad who shared the guard with me that night of whirling snow, what other nights have brought to you I may not know. Although I never heard your name and hardly saw your face, you poured out all your heart to me as we kept pace. I don't know if you're living still or fallen in the fight, but in my heart your heart is safe till the last night. Then a poem by a much less well-known poet, G.A. Studdard Kennedy, is called His Mate. There's a broken, battered village somewhere up behind the line. There's a dugout and a bunk there that I used to say were mine. I remember how we reached them, dripping wet and all forlorn, in the dim and dreary twilight of a weeping summer dawn. All that week I'd buried brothers in one bitter battle slain. In one grave I laid 200. God, what sorrow and what rain. And that night I'd been in trenches, seeking out the sodden dead, and just dropping them in shell holes with a service swiftly sent. For the bullets rattled round me, but I couldn't leave them there, water soaked in flooded shell holes, reft of common Christian prayer. So I crawled round on my belly, and I listened to the roar of the guns that hammered tipfowl like big breakers on the shore. Then there spoke a dripping sergeant when the time was growing late, "Would you please to bury this one, 'cause he used to be my mate?" So we groped our way in darkness, to a body lying there, just a blacker lump of blackness with a red blotch on his hair. Though we turned him gently over, yet I still can hear the thud as the body fell face forward and then settled in the mud. We went down upon our faces, and I said the service through, from I am the resurrection to the last, the great adieu. We stood up to give the blessing and commend him to the Lord, when a sudden light shot soaring, silver swift and like a sword. At a stroke it slew the darkness, flashed its glory on the mud. And I saw the sergeant staring at a crimson clot of blood. There are many kinds of sorrow in this world of love and hate, but there is no sterner sorrow than a soldier's for his mate. Then the one poem not connected with the First World War, it's connected with the American Civil War, "As Toilsome I Wandered Virginia's Woods" by Walt Whitman. "As toilsome I wandered Virginia's woods, to the music of rustling leaves kicked by my feet, for it was autumn, I marked at the foot of a tree the grave of a soldier. Mortally wounded he, and buried on the retreat. Easily all could I understand, the halt of a midday hour, when up, no time to lose, yet this sign left, on a tablet scrawled and nailed on the tree by the grave. Bold, cautious, true, and my loving comrade. Long, long I muse, then on my way go wandering, many a changeful season to follow, and many a scene of life. Yet at times through changeful season and scene, abrupt, alone, or in the crowded street, comes before me the unknown soldier's grave. Comes the inscription rude in Virginia's woods. Old, cautious, true, and my loving comrade." Then a rather famous poem by Wilfred Owen called "Futility." Move him into the sun. Gently its touch awoke him once at home, whispering of fields half sown. Always it woke him, even in France, until this morning and this snow. If anything might rouse him now, the kind old sun will know. Think how it wakes the seeds, woke once the clays of a cold star. Are limbs so dear achieved, are sides full nerved, still warm, too hard to stir? Was it for this the clay grew tall? Oh, what made fatuous sunbeams toil to break earth's sleep at all? A poem of a rather different kind, serious, even tragic, but with a humorous touch. I won't tell you it's by, I'm going to give you three guesses at the end. Eh? It's called "The Pilot," and it's the last poem in this particular section. "The Pilot." He drank when he was hardly 17, and girls disliked his touch. His hands were never over clean. His language tiresomely obscene. He drank too much. As clerk to a solicitor at Bow, his study was the law. He studied dogs, which ran too slow, and women, when the price was low, then came the war. He said that he had always longed to fly. He liked the sense of power. His mother wept. He knew not why. She pleaded, but he said goodbye. This was his hour. He gave up drink and smoking, forged his age, and somehow passed as fit. He stepped as from a weary cage, receiver of a royal wage, and proud of it. He learned to laugh, to march with head erect, and why an army sings. He learned to value self-respect, to live as one of the elect. He earned his wings. He learned to think, to fight and fly alone, to hold on to the end, to face the known and the unknown, to merge in movements not his own. He made a friend. They messed together, raced for every prize, proved dear each other's worth. And then his friend, before his eyes, too far defied the sullen skies and crashed to earth. He heard his voice within the burning plain and frantic fumbled through. They strove to hold him back, in vain. Triumphantly he tried again and perished too. He was a child of joyless circumstance, wrapped in a narrow span, bereft of purpose or romance, yet this he found, self-governance. He died a man. Well, who's that by? Christmas Humphreys. He was quite a good poet. All right, fifth and last section, Higher Dimensions. I'm going to start off with a sonnet by a New Zealand poet, R.A.K. Mason, and it's called Sonnet of Brotherhood. Again, it's one of those difficult modern poets which allow you to breathe only twice in the course of the whole poem. But again, we'll do our best. Sonnet of Brotherhood. Garrisons pent up in a little fort, with foes who do but wait on every side, knowing the time soon comes when they shall ride triumphant over those trapped and make sport of them. When those within know very short is now their hour, and no aid can betide. Such men as these not quarrel and divide, but friend and foe are friends in their hard assault. And if these things be so, O men, then what of these beleaguered victims, this our race, betrayed alike by fate's gigantic plot, here in this far-pitched, perilous, hostile place, this solitary, hard-assaulted spot, fixed at the friendless outer edge of space? Then Walt Whitman once again, I hear it was charged against me. I hear it was charged against me that I sought to destroy institutions. But really, I am neither for nor against institutions. What indeed have I in common with them, or what with the destruction of them? Only I will establish in the Manor Hatter, and in every city of these states, inland and seaboard, and in the fields and woods, and above every keel, little or large, that dents the water, without edifices, or rules, or trustees, or any argument. The institution of the dear love of comrades. Now from the 19th back to the 18th century, and to a poet who isn't much read these days, Edward Young. He's the author of Night Thoughts. Most of us know it as one of the works illustrated by William Blake, but it's well worth reading on its own account. His style is rather condensed and tortuous. I've selected just a very short passage, which will give you a little of his flavour, and of course something more about friendship. It's from Night Second, which is entitled On Time, Death and Friendship. Celestial happiness, whene'er she stoops to visit earth, one shrine the goddess finds, and one alone to make her sweet amends for absent heaven, the bosom of a friend, where heart meets heart, reciprocally soft, each other's pillow to repose divine. Beware the counterfeit. In passion's flame hearts melt, but melt like ice, soon harder froze. True love strikes root in reason, passion's foe. Virtue alone entenders us for life. I wrong her much, entenders us forever. Of friendship's fairest fruits, the fruit most fair is virtue kindling at a rival fire, and amorously rapid in her race. Oh, the soft enmity, endearing strife, this carries friendship to her noontide point, and gives the rivet of eternity. Then an extract from In Memoriam, the series of elegies written by Tennyson in memory of his very dear friend Arthur Hallam, who died very young. Who loves not knowledge? Who shall rail against her beauty? May she mix with men and prosper. Who shall fix her pillars? Let her work prevail. But on her forehead sits a fire. She sets her forward countenance and leaps into the future chance, submitting all things to desire. Half grown as yet, a child, and vain, she cannot fight the fear of death. What is she, cut from love and faith, but some wild palace from the brain of demons, fiery hot to burst all barriers in her onward race for power? Let her know her place. She is the second, not the first. A higher hand must make her mild, if all be not in vain, and guide her footsteps, moving side by side with wisdom, like the younger child. For she is earthly of the mind, but wisdom heavenly of the soul. O friend, who camest to thy goal so early, leaving me behind, I would the great world grew like thee, who grewest not alone in power and knowledge, but by year and hour in reverence and in charity. Now the last poem but one, this is a Persian poem, it's a Persian Sufi poem, an extract from the Masnavi of Jalaluddin Rumi, the Persian poet of the 13th century who was the founder of the order of dervishes, the whirling dervishes. The Masnavi from which this extract is taken is a very, very celebrated, very long poem, often called the Quran of Persia on account of its very extensive influence. Once, a man came and knocked at the door of his friend. His friend said, "Who art thou, O faithful one?" He said, "'Tis I." He answered, "There is no admittance. There is no room for the raw at my well-cooked feast. Naught but fire of separation and absence can cook the raw one and free him from hypocrisy. Since thyself has not yet left thee, thou must be burned in fiery flames." The poor man went away, and for one whole year journeyed burning with grief for his friend's absence. His heart burned till it was cooked. Then he went again and drew near to the house of his friend. He knocked at the door in fear and trepidation, lest some careless word should fall from his lips. His friend shouted, "Who is that at the door?" He answered, "'Tis thou who art at the door, O beloved." The friend said, "Since 'tis I, let me come in. There is not room for two eyes in one house." And the last poem, the same sort of message in very, very few words. It's a Japanese haiku by the famous Zen hermit and poet Ryokan, whose dates are roughly the same as those of our own William Blake. Singing waka, reciting poems, playing ball together in the fields, two people, one heart. Thank you very much, Banti. It's been a very good evening, very good selection of poems. I really found some of them quite inspiring. So it would be nice to have an anthology of them or something like that sometime. And I'm sure, you know, we'll all look forward to perhaps another visit sometime. We've just got a small presentation for you.
Thank you, Marina.
And so, thanks again to Banti, and we'll now go over to the book launch from Naga Birdie.
Thanks, Damaruchi. As Damaruchi said, it's been a very inspiring evening, and I imagine that for many people here, whether to their surprise or not, they found that an evening of poetry on the theme of friendship turned out to be a spiritual experience, an experience at least which demonstrated that friendship is a spiritual quality and that its development is a spiritual practice. So that might answer a riddle that perhaps some others of you came here. Why is it that Sangharakshita, who makes so few public appearances, as Damaruchi put it at the beginning, turns up at one of our centres, with these once-in-the-blue-moon moments, And rather than giving a talk on Buddhism, because after all he's a Buddhist teacher, he presents us with an anthology of poetry. Well, if you came with a question like that in your mind, perhaps by now it's answered, that in reciting poetry, not even his own poetry, but reciting from his very, very broad knowledge of poetry to us, he's managed to be a Buddhist teacher. And this is something which I think has characterized just about everything that Sangharakshita does. I've been very lucky to see Sangharakshita under a lot of different moons and suns in a lot of different aspects. I work with him in a sort of businessy way sometimes as one of his main publishers. I've sat in Indian fields and listened to him give talks to thousands of ex-untouchable Buddhists. I've seen him give lectures in London or lead intimate study seminars in Norfolk. In all sorts of ways, I've watched Sangharakshita operating in completely different fashions, but always that the message comes across the same. There's this seed of spiritual experience which, through putting down the roots of his living experience, he manages to bring forth and utter joyous leaves of Dharma in all sorts of ways, in all sorts of media, which is an absolutely awe-inspiring and wonderful thing to behold and witness. And I think it's this, it's not the word, isn't skill, this ability of Sangharakshita's to communicate Dharma in all sorts of contexts, in all sorts of ways, to all sorts of different kinds of people through different media, that has made him such a successful person. Because probably his most successful, his greatest achievement is the creation of the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, the Buddhist movement of which this centre here in Croydon is one part or one aspect. Sometimes the word translator is used, that Sangharakshita has the ability to translate the essence of Buddhist practice and tradition, to translate this into the idiom and the language of the culture in which he's operating. Well, perhaps that's one way of putting it. Now, how else could our movement have succeeded in so many different cultures? I mean, just in this room, and I don't know everyone, but I can see somebody from the United States, someone from New Zealand, someone from Germany, Sweden, Holland. These people are all involved in our movement, which is now more or less worldwide. And this is because of Sangharakshita's skill as a translator. Now, perhaps that skill was never more fully required than back in the late 60s, early 70s, even mid-70s, when the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order was getting underway. Because in those days, Buddhism wasn't understood or practiced in the West in the way that it is now. In those days, it was quite possible to go to a sort of Buddhist summer school and hear talks on Buddhism, but also hear talks on Zoroastrianism, or be persuaded to put a paper bag over your head so that you lost awareness of your identity. All this sort of stuff wrapped up and palmed off as Buddhism in all good faith and with good heart, because not very long ago, you know, not many of us in the West had much of an understanding for what Buddhism actually was as a path, something that we could actually follow and practice in a progressive, viable sort of way. And Sangharakshita must have been one of the leading pioneers of the movement that has made it possible for us Westerners to do this, to practice the Dharma. And in those years, the late 60s, early and mid 70s, Sangharakshita was particularly busy. He would go around the place giving a lot of lectures on all sorts of aspects of traditional Buddhist teaching, giving seminars on anything from Buddhist sutras to the duties of brotherhood in Islam or the poetry of Samuel Johnson, you know, to communicate in all sorts of ways to as many people as he could what being a Buddhist, what practicing Buddhism is actually about. Now, for me, three lectures that he gave during that period, which was a very exciting period in the history of our own movement, because it was at that sort of time that this centre was coming into being. It was at that sort of time that the London Buddhist Centre was being found and built. But during this era, Sangharakshita gave three talks. The Path of regular steps in the path of irregular steps, enlightenment as experience and as non-experience, and the taste of freedom. He gave the first two of those talks, in fact, under the auspices of the Buddhist Society, with the great British poet, Christmas Humphreys, firmly in the chair. And I was lucky enough to be at all of them. So in a certain way, they were landmark talks. It would be difficult to sift out which of Sangharakshita's lectures have been most important. Perhaps these weren't the most important, but they definitely acted as landmarks. Often, if you circulate within FWBO circles, you'll hear mention of the path of regular steps. Oh, so-and-so's still on a path of irregular steps. This person's on a path of regular steps. Now, where did these phrases come from? And people way, way back used to refer to a path. It's one of these sort of words that theosophists would use, and even back further beyond, the idea of being on a path, i.e. being interested, maybe involved in some way in Eastern mysticism. But in this lecture, the path of irregular steps and the path of regular steps, Sangharakshita demonstrated that one didn't have to be vague about it. One didn't have to be confused. One didn't have to hunt and peck. It was possible to practice the thing in the secure knowledge that you were on a progressive, reliable path. And in that way, that talk was a real landmark. In enlightenment as experience and as non-experience, Sangharakshita looked at the whole way in which we Westerners approach spiritual experience. Why do we tend to look at our practice of Buddhism or of religion as something which is going to culminate in an experience, to the extent that we get so attached to the idea that we just confuse ourselves and get lost? In that lecture, he demonstrated again how the spiritual life was something to be lived on a very practical sort of basis, that work, for example, played a central part, not just in the means, but almost in the end of the spiritual life. And then in the taste of freedom, I think Sangharakshita put some more words into our vocabulary. They're old English words, but he gave them a new twist. He gave a new twist to the words habit, superficiality, and vagueness, offering these as his more modern equivalent translations of the three traditional fetters, which I won't enumerate here and now. But in various ways, these three talks were particular landmarks. I think they changed the whole shape and direction, not just of our movement, but of a lot of us, of our own personal experience of the spiritual life. And it's for that reason I'm delighted to launch this book, The Taste of Freedom, which contains those three lectures. It's not a big book. It ought to be bigger because the printers used the wrong paper for it, but we won't go on about that. It's a little book. It would have been little even so, but it packs an enormous punch. In those three talks, you have, in principle, everything you need to know about the spirit of Buddhist practice. Now, there's also very direct practical teaching, but if you've read and assimilated these three talks, you know what the Buddhist life and the Buddhist path is actually about. So I really hope that you'll go straight off and buy a copy. It costs a laughable £3.50, and for that small sum, you'll not only have the book, but if you buy it tonight, Sangharakshita is prepared to sign your copy for you. So please remember that as we go out for tea. Thank you. Okay, thank you, Margaret Bailey. I'm sure we'll all be going to buy A Taste of Freedom in a few minutes. But before that, I've got a few announcements to make. Let's see, where do we start? While we're on the subject of books, I'd just like to mention a few more. I mentioned this one earlier on, the last three copies that we've got. This is one, the other two are through there. So The Enchanted Heart. It's packed with poetry by Sangharakshita from, the 1940s to about 1960-something or other. There's a lot in there. It conveys quite a lot just of his spiritual experience when he was in India as a young man. And there's also Conquering New Worlds, another volume of his poetry. And then
not poetry, but autobiography, is The Thousand Petal Lotus. That covers Sangharakshita's travels in India as a young man, in, well, late 40s, early 50s, I suppose. This is a very good book indeed. I've read it about three or four times myself. I was hearing about someone tonight who's read it 9 times. Most people seem to read it several times, so pick it up every few years. It's a very good book indeed. So there's those three. Then I'd just like to make a few announcements about what's happening here at the Croydon Buddhist Centre. First of all, for those of you who haven't been here before and who are perhaps new to Buddhism, we run quite a lot of introductory events. We've got introductory meditation classes every Wednesday lunchtime and Wednesday evening. Everything I'm talking about, by the way, is in this programme, which you can get out there. Then, if you want to plunge in a bit deeper, we have weekend retreats down in Sussex. We have a very nice country house down there, and we run weekend events. You can get quite a deep taste of what Buddhism, meditation, etc. can do for you in quite ideal conditions. The next weekend we've got there is the 26th to the 28th of January. That's in, well, I think that's the weekend after next. We've got a day event coming up on the 28th of January. That's our Sunday week. It's a day on Buddhism and death, and that's being led by Vara Badri, who's a woman order member from our centre in East London. We've reserved 4 places for that for people who are completely new to the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. So if you'd like to come on that, please book up. The places will go if you don't book soon. It's proving quite popular. We're also running a series of lectures starting on the 28th of January. That's in, well, 2 weeks tomorrow. The overall title is Buddhism and the World Today. And the first one is called The Need for Myth. I think they charge just £1 for the lectures, and they're just quite a good introduction to Buddhism and a good thing for people to come along to who perhaps haven't been along before. Then, finally, the question of money. We're not charging for tonight, but we're going to have an appeal for donations. Not to run this centre, but for our work in India. We do quite a lot of work amongst ex-untouchable Buddhists in India, in Pune, Bombay, Ahmedabad, Aurangabad, and, well, we need money to run it, basically, and all the proceeds from tonight are going to go towards that. There'll be a bowl out on the desk in the bookshop, so anything put in there, £1, £2, £5, £20, a little bit of money goes a long way in India, so it would be much appreciated. Okay, so we'll go through now to the bookshop where tea will be served. Our Sangharakshita will be signing copies of any of his books you'd like to buy. And that's it for tonight, and look forward to seeing you again. And thank you again to Banti.